It's 6:05 and you're listening to The Roadhouse on WTIP, and we're going to be speaking with Dr. Michael Joyner from Mayo Clinic. He's a physiological researcher, and there's a very long title for what he actually does. Perhaps you'd like to tell us what you do, Dr. Joyner.
Well, I do lots of things, but one of my jobs at Mayo is to conduct research, and one of the things we study is how humans respond to exercise.
Which involves some pleasure and some pain and some gain and some work along the way, I imagine.
Sure does. And we're interested in all sorts of things. We're interested in athletic performance. We're interested in the effects of exercise on aging. We're also interested in some very basic stuff, like what makes blood flow to your muscle go up when you exercise. Because if the blood flow doesn't go up, you don't have enough oxygen and other things going to your muscle, and eventually will fatigue.
So when you don't have enough oxygen going to your muscles, what's the result of that?
Well, there's all sorts of things that can happen, but a couple of things happen. The first thing that happens is your blood vessels try to open up more and increase the blood flow, so the oxygen delivery and the blood supply is, in fact, adequate. And that's a pretty powerful collection of mechanisms or events or responses that usually can keep things in pretty good shape. Now, if the blood flow is restricted because you have vascular disease or some other problem, or if you're at very, very high altitude, it can make it hard for the muscle to generate the energy it needs and keep contracting, so that ultimately you fatigue.
Right. And so for people who are listening who are, Cook County has lots of elite athletes, but we also have a few people that are just regular folks that go out and jog and paddle and
right.
do other things like that. You know, what does that help them figure out with their exercise regimen?
Well, I think the main thing is a couple things. One is when you exercise, your blood flow goes up.
Mm-hmm.
When your blood flow goes up, the inside of your blood vessels become very, very healthy, and the increased blood flow through your muscles and through your heart help prevent plaques and other things that tend to clog the blood vessels up from either starting or growing. That's really one of the main health benefits, keeping the linings of the blood vessels relatively clean and keeping things wide open so people aren't as affected by things like heart disease, hypertension, and believe it or not, diabetes, because when the blood vessels are healthy, it's easier for the glucose to get to the muscles, and the glucose goes to the muscles where it's taken up instead of the fat cells where it would tend to contribute to diabetes, or at least be a risk factor for diabetes. So exercise does all sorts of good things.
And that increased blood flow, I imagine, is also taking waste products faster away from the muscles
yes.
after you've done your exercise.
You bet.
Sure.
You bet.
One of the things I was noticing in your research was it was talking about lactate threshold. And
you know,
one of the wives' tales, and honestly one of the ones that I have to admit I believed, was that the reason I'm hurting the day after a long, hard run is because I've got lactic acid buildup.
Yeah, that is one of the great wives' tales. And it turns out the lactic acid is gone from your muscles 10, 20, 30 minutes after you get done exercising. It goes away faster if you do active recovery, walk or jog, if you've been doing something very, very hard. And what makes you sore a day or two after you exercise is a whole different collection of events, probably related to microtrauma in the muscle, tickling little sensory nerves, and that's what makes you sore. You notice sometimes you're sore the day after, but you're especially sore 2 or 3 days after.
Oh, yes.
And especially if you've gone downhill and you're not used to going downhill, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's called delayed muscle soreness, and that's what causes that. But lactic acid, it's been responsible for everything, solar eclipses, plagues, all kinds of things. When in reality, it's overrated, you know.
Yeah. So for the average person who's trying to, be healthy and live a little
right.
longer and all this thing, is there a magic number? Is there a magic amount of exercise that they should be doing?
There's a couple of answers to that question. If you start looking at the health benefits of exercise, it's kind of a curvilinear relationship where at some point you get to diminishing returns. But there's sort of a magic number for health maintenance. This isn't for optimum health, and it's not for optimum physical performance. But if people are able to engage in vigorous physical activity about 150 minutes a week, that's 5 times a week for 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
It has tremendous protective effects in terms of preventing diabetes, preventing hypertension, and also preventing heart disease. Now, obviously, if you're training for a marathon or if you're going to climb mountains or do some of the more extreme outdoor sports that a lot of folks up there do, that's not going to get you in shape for that. But in terms of really kind of the first shot or the most important part of the exercise, that first 30 minutes every day, really helps us combat the negative effects of the sedentary lifestyle so many people have adopted.
Sure, just 30 minutes a day is going to get the biggest gain, the biggest bang for the buck.
Well, and see, the important thing about that is the average person who's a couch potato who's thinking, gee, maybe I should get more exercise, looks at somebody and says, God, I can't run a marathon, or I can't go out and train all, do this and do that and do other things. But, a lot of people can find 30 minutes 5 days a week.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people don't realize that some of the things that they might do every single day end up qualifying as good exercise if they just step them up a little bit, walking or...
Brisk walking, park in the parking lot, walk a little farther, take the stairs. You name it, gardening, and really any physical activity is protective against these diseases. But as you mentioned earlier in one of your questions, are you trying to add more, are you trying to add more years to your life or more life to your years? And I think that's the other thing people have to recognize about exercise.
Sure.
Is let's try to get more life to our years.
Well, one of the other recovery issues that I was wondering about, and there's been some controversy about this, and I'm not sure if your research covers it, but stretching before and or after exercise.
Yeah, we're into about the third or fourth wave of that.
Mm-hmm.
Where stretching was good, then stretching was not so good, then you were supposed to do static stretching, then you weren't supposed to bounce. Now, maybe you're supposed to bounce. Other people claim now the most recent stuff claims that stretching prior to a workout may not be the best thing in terms of it might actually slow you down a little bit, as counterintuitive as that sounds. And some people have argued that you might want to save your stretching till after the workout.
Mm-hmm.
That's the current state of the play, but again, these things recycle every so often, and so it's unclear if that's the final answer.
Well, I'm waiting for the research to come around to that chocolate and coffee are actually the best things for you.
Well, there is pretty good data about coffee, actually, and caffeine is been shown in a number of studies to actually improve performance. Plus, it tastes good,
especially with chocolate.
And I agree with you. Indeed, if you're working out, the calories don't bother you.
So there was another little nugget that I noticed in your research that you don't necessarily have to, if you haven't been a real active person your entire life, what's going to make the biggest difference to your later years is that the time what you do during your 40, 50, and 60 years.
Yeah, exactly, and that is so critical. I think what we all, or at least some people, are laboring under the misconception that aging is going to be this kind of downward cycle, ratcheting down of physical capacity, increased disability, and frailty. But if people start making decisions to be physically active in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, a lot of that frailty and disability can be just not going to happen, or be eliminated, or be slowed. And if you look at people who've either been physically active their whole life or become physically active in middle age, they have, in addition to having longer lifespans, the amount of time that they call disability-free life
mm-hmm.
goes way up. And I think we all see it. I mean, I'm sure people that are in their middle 80s that really don't have a lot of limitations. But then we all know people who are in their middle 80s who just aren't doing very well.
Right. And, anecdotally, there's an awful lot of people here in Cook County who, kind of go like the Energizer Bunny until they're about 90 or 95.
Right.
And the universal truth there is that they've all done things their whole lives.
Well,
they've been active.
And there's some studies, if you look at these so-called blue zones, where there are large numbers of people that are older, the most notable one in the U.S. is the Seventh-day Adventist out in California, who are physically active, don't smoke, watch their weight, don't eat a whole lot of meat, and they live to be about 90 on average, and then they die suddenly. which I think is kind of a similar experience to what you just mentioned.
Live a long time and go quickly. You can't ask for much more than that.
Exactly.
Speaking of the latter years, is there any relationship to exercise and Alzheimer's?
Yeah, it's very interesting you mention that because for a long, long time, people have thought that the primary cause of cognitive impairment with aging was some deterioration of the nerve cells. But when people start looking at the risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and cognitive impairment, most of the risk factors are the same risk factors as they are for heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, cholesterol. And it turns out there's some evidence that physical inactivity, not physical activity, but physical inactivity is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease.
Hmm.
And there is even more evidence that people who get mild cognitive impairment and become physically active, the rate at which their brain function declines is slowed. And then there are some animal models that tend to confirm that. So one idea that's emerging is that a lot of the diseases of aging, including Alzheimer's disease, affect the very, very small blood vessels. And things like diabetes and hypertension kind of trash those vessels and ultimately trash the organs that surround those blood vessels.
Everything becomes less efficient all the way around.
Exactly.
So, you know, you do this research and you see all these benefits.
Right.
What do you do to keep yourself healthy right now?
Well, like, I just swam 3,000 meters before this interview. And then tomorrow, I'll like ride my bike for 45 minutes and then go and do some interval training on a trail near my house for about 45 minutes.
And
so what I try to do is bike and run one day and then swim the next day. And then on most of the days I swim, I also weightlift.
Sure. So you're spreading it around the different muscle groups and doing some different things.
Well, in college and high school, I was mostly a runner, and until my early 40s, I mostly ran, but I started getting kind of chronic hamstring problems, some back pain, and switching to this kind of alternate protocol seems to have helped.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all of us, as we get a little older, we find there's certain things that we can do that we love doing, and there's certain things that we have to kind of give up, and some of us are just too silly to stop doing them.
Well, and I think the other thing is if you talk to some of these master athletes, Dara Torres, the swimmer, there was this terrific rower from Finland named Pardi Karppinen, and he can still do one race in his middle 40s or even late 40s as fast as he could when he was quite a bit younger, but he said he can't do three in 3 days. So I think recovery, that's what I've noticed especially, recovery is a bigger problem. And going a couple hard days in a row is more challenging now than it was when you know 21, 22.
Yeah, well, my 15-year-old son runs, and he can run an awful lot of days of the week, and he seems to just spring right back into it the next morning, and he's just fine. And I run the same amount he does, and I'm hurting for a couple of days afterwards. But
exactly,
we keep ourselves honest.
Yep.
Well, this is really interesting. Is there anything in particular that you'd like our guests to know about the research, or is there any way, like if people wanted to participate in it, is there a way that people can do that?
They sure can. If they wanted to come down here and participate in some of our studies, we're always looking for master athletes and healthy older people. And the best way to do it is just to email me, joiner.michael@mayo.edu, and it's joiner, and I'll forward it to my study coordinators, and they'll contact you.
And they could also go to the Mayo website and just do a search for Dr. Michael Joiner, and that would get you there, too. Buck, I think maybe you should get hooked up with this guy.
Well, you know, this is Buck Benson, Dr. Joiner.
Hi, Buck.
And I had a question, of course.
Yeah.
I've been doing various competitions over the years, and as part of training for cross-country skiing, one of the main things that you run into going to camps is it's called long slow distance, or LSD. What they want to do, of course, is monitor you for lactic acid and each day you, and also your heart rate. When they're seeing results as to lactic acid decreasing, since you've shown that it's really a fallacy, what are they really seeing then?
Oh, you know, Buck, it's a kind of a complex question.
Okay.
One of the things is that what you look at is there something called your VO2 max, your maximum oxygen consumption, and that's the equivalent of how many horsepower your car has. Then there's something called the lactate threshold, which is sort of like the red line in a car, the old muscle cars. And that is really how fast you can run until you start to have lactic acid build up in your bloodstream and in your muscle. And again, the wives' tales about lactic acid aside, that it turns out that most people can do a marathon at about the pace where they start to see a little bit of lactate in their blood. Now, the more you train, the higher that level gets. So an untrained person, about 60% of their maximum, they start to produce lactate. A trained person, maybe 80 or even 90%. So what happens is your horsepower goes up, your VO2 max goes up, and you can sustain a higher percentage of your VO2 max over time. So that's what people are trying to do, both with long, slow-distance training, and also interval training can help that as well. And then you get into this monitoring. You know, do you use a heart rate monitor? Do you monitor your lactic acid? Do you do this? Do you do that? And I personally just try to go on how I feel, which is, you know, more of a what they call perceived exertion technique, which is another way to do it. My life is regimented and complicated enough. I don't necessarily need a heart rate monitor, yeah, lactic acid monitor, and so on and so forth. So I actually do a lot of fartlek training where you go fast and slow and kind of run to this landmark or run to that landmark.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of clears it up for me. You know, I thought maybe that, the whole idea might have been not real, but it sounds like there's something to that as well, the LSD training. So
yeah, and what people, I always like to tell people, we need to party like it's 1964. In the 5,000 meters at the Tokyo Olympics, the winner was a man named Bob Shull, an American from Ohio. He's the only American, I think, who ever won the 5,000 meters. And he was a classic interval trainer for folks in your audience who know what that is. It'll make sense. But for the other people, that means he did, short, fast bursts followed by short, slow bursts. He did two interval workouts a day, every day, 6 days a week. The second place finisher was a man named Harald Norpoth from Germany, who was one of the original long, slow distance guys. Was running 150 miles a week and hardly any of it fast. And the third place finisher was a man named Bill Dellinger, also from the U.S., who later became the track coach at Oregon following Bill Bowerman, the Nike waffle shoe guy. And Dellinger did a mixture, did some interval training, some distance running, this, that, and the other thing. So I think there's, a lot of, it's like what the religious mystics will tell you, it's, what, different fingers pointing at the same moon?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a lot of different ways to train. And people have to find out what works for them.
But the bottom line is people should do something.
Something every day.
Just
and if you're going to be an elite competitor like I understand you are, and one of you guys is trying to climb some mountain.
Oh.
Yeah,
sounds like our producer has been talking.
Yeah,
she's been feeding you.
She's been bragging on you guys. But anyways, if you're going to do that, then you have to train hard and a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be my role then, I guess. So I better get at it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll keep an eye on him for you and check his VO2 max regularly.
Well, I think the other thing too, thinking about what other people were talking a little bit about aging, the other thing I think that becomes important as you get older is doing some sort of strength training. Now, whether if you live in a more urban environment like I do, you actually maybe have to weightlift or do some push-ups or pull-ups or something like that, where folks up there, maybe chopping wood.
I was going to say, we just heat with wood.
Yeah, or haul stuff or shovel or whatever it is.
Or just getting the boat hooked up to the trailer hitch.
Yeah, or carrying portaging or whatever, But again, I think that becomes critical as you get older. And if you look at those people you were mentioning earlier, these robust people in their 80s and 90s, you'll notice a lot of those folks, in comparison to frail people you see in cities, still have some muscle mass.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been really interesting, a lot of great information, and I think some motivational information, too, for folks who will maybe take advantage of some of this and live a little longer and exercise a little bit more. We thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Nice to visit you guys.
Thank you, Doctor.
Good luck on that mountain climb, too.
Thank you.
Yep. Take care.